Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications, and every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today on this sunny Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of speaking with Brian Halligan, co-founder and CEO of HubSpot, and he's actually on the East Coast. So you're in Cambridge, Massachusetts, yes?
That's right. Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
How's the weather there?
It's not bad. We've had two straight weeks of rain, so I actually see something very unusual popping out, and that's blue in the sky today.
Oh, well, that's a good omen for us. So I wanted to start out talking a little bit about HubSpot's rise and, you know, your role as a co-founder and, of course, the CEO of the company. How long has it been from idea to execution, and what was the inspiration?
It's been about 3 years, actually to the week next week.
Wow.
I was a venture capitalist before I started HubSpot, and the idea sort of came from there. I spent a lot of time working with venture-backed, mostly software companies, but services companies and other types of companies, helping them think through how to grow and how do we use sales and marketing effectively to grow. And in getting to know the entrepreneurs and the marketing folks, I just saw how the sort of traditional rules of marketing, sort of sending email blasts and doing telemarketing, trade shows, seminars, advertising, gosh, they just didn't seem to be working as well as they used to in the 1990s when I sort of cut my teeth in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of came to the conclusion that traditional marketing was just broken as people have gotten better at blocking it out, whether they're blocking it out with TiVo on their television or spam protection on their PC or caller ID. People are just sick and tired of being marketed to, is my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And in my eventual co-founder, a guy I went to MIT with, he had started a blog around this time. It was called OnStartups.com. And he had like a ton of interest in his blog. He had tons of Google love going on. He had lots of other bloggers linking to him. And he was exceptionally clever about how he leveraged social media sites back then. Dig and Reddit were the primary ones to turn his blog into a hub on the internet. So what I started thinking about is how do I help these software companies transform the way they market from kind of outbound interrupting people into buying their products too. How do we help them get found by people kind of in the natural way that they kind of shop and learn? People sort of shop and learn in Google and in blogs and in social media sites now. So the idea was sort of hatched as a VC, as a marketing transformation idea. How do we help companies transform the way they market? Actually, to make a long story short, we started introducing these companies to new technology to help them with the transformation. So we'd introduce them to SEO consultants, and we'd introduce them to AdWords and landing pages and to blogging software and social media tools and web analytics and content management systems. And very, very quickly, they became sort of overwhelmed with all the new technology. And that's kind of where HubSpot was born out of. How do we create sort of a simple, integrated, kind of modern marketing platform to help people pull this stuff off and get found by more customers by pulling together a little bit of SEO software, a little bit of landing pages and blogging software and social media tools and analytics into one simple integrated tool. And, yeah, that was 3 years ago.
So it's 3 years in the making, and where you are now is obviously being known for, you know, the wonderful, as I was saying to you before we started the show, I think, you know, a really great example of, you know, what we hope our clients achieve, which is landing on a page that feels friendly. It has a kind of a persona of its own that works really well and maps very well to what people know maybe know HubSpot the most for, which is the free tools that you offer. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the birth of your storytelling or messaging strategy on the site and strategy around the free tools? And then I'm going to follow up, obviously, and ask you about the software component, obviously,
sure,
being a pay piece.
Sure. It's a very good question. Before we even started writing the software and building the company and even having a website, we started with a blog, which is now blog.hubspot.com. So 3 years ago, before Line of Code was written, my co-founder and I spent nights and weekends writing about our idea and exploring the idea and sort of engaging the blogosphere around whether did people think this was a good idea and were the ideas we were espousing resonating. And we used our blog and we used the feedback we got through the blogosphere to sort of hone our message and hone the strategy. So, we started by blogging, getting market feedback, and then we turned that feedback into a software company, essentially. So early on, the blog was very influential. We just kept creating content on the blog. Now, frankly, I write a lot less on it because we've hired some better writers than me to write on the blog. So that's how that sort of started, was very early. We were creating tons of content. And it turns out that blog is an absolute magnet for us for leads. So we very much eat our own dog food. We write as compelling content as we can. What happens with a good blog is people link to it, and those links send you traffic, obviously, but those links are the main thing that influences Google. So you got to get this reinforcing loop. You write good content, you get lots of links, you move up in the search engines, and round you go. So that's the blog. In terms of the free tools, the first free tool we built was called Website Grader. And it was a mistake. It was a real hit by mistake. We built it because when we were talking to our early potential customers, we had lots of interest from coming in from people we knew from MIT and from the Boston community. And people wanted to meet with us. And before we'd meet with them, we'd have to go and look at their site and try to figure out if they got this internet marketing stuff. So we'd do things like look at all their metadata on their site, look at how many links they had, would look at how many delicious bookmarks they had. Do they have an account with Dig? We looked at all this interesting information to figure out if they're a good fit for HubSpot and how clueful or clueless they were about the internet. And my co-founder one day said, "This takes too long. Let's just build a little tool that will help us figure out if they're a good fit for HubSpot or if they know what they're talking about before we get in the meeting."
We sure got a good URL in the process.
We did get a good URL.
Very clever. They own
Grader.com. And then we were just using it ourselves. And then one day he says, "You know what? Why don't we just let the community grade themselves?" And so we turned it around and opened it up to the community, and it really took off. And so then we've done a bunch more. So we built Twitter Grader, which has been a huge hit for us, like Website Grader, Facebook Grader, Press Release Grader. We've got Blog Grader coming out in the next week or two. Grader's gone wild over here at HubSpot.
And what are kind of the algorithms that go behind that? Because it never ceases to amaze me how I will find out about new technology. So months and months ago, I was aware of Twitter Grader, but hadn't really, I knew what it was, but wasn't necessarily, didn't have a reason to necessarily, actively engage with it. And somebody messaged me based on the grade that apparently I came up in a local search or something like that. So anyway, they blogged about it and then messaged me and through an at reply. So it was kind of funny that I became part of the tool without actively engaging with it. So that's sort of the nirvana of a tool with that kind of long tail is fantastic.
Yeah, that thing's worked out well. We started it gets 20,000-30,000 visitors a day. It's really been an interesting phenomenon. We're thrilled with it. The interesting things about the algorithms, we don't publish them, and they're controversial. So the Twitter Grader algorithm, a lot of people want us just to measure and give you a grade based on the number of your followers, right?
Right.
Now, the problem
is
not fair. It doesn't really represent, we don't think, the power of that person, because let's say I go out and I follow tons and tons of people before Twitter put any limits on it, just follow tons of people. There's a certain amount of people who are going to follow me back, sort of automatically, because so many people use bots these days to do that. So we just didn't think it was fair to count the number of followers. So we changed it, and in our algorithm, I'll tell you what it involves. I won't tell you the ratios, but it involves number of people following you relative to the number of people you follow. So if you're heavily followed relative to the number of people you're following, it means you're writing stuff interesting on Twitter, and people find your stuff interesting, and you're spreading, and you're becoming a magnet, basically.
So
one of the other things that's in there.
The ratios
important.
Yeah, and people have talked a lot about that. So again, not a popularity contest as much as it is an engagement. You're trying to make it an engagement metric more than
we are. A couple other interesting controversial things in there is we look at the power of your followers. So is Guy Kawasaki following you? Is Ashton Kutcher following you? Or is it a bunch of people with no mojo following you?
So fantastic lead up to that is how do you determine who's influential enough to be included in the algorithm without giving anything proprietary away?
We look at their Twitter grade. It's like a reinforcing thing. A couple of the things we look at is are people retweeting the stuff you're tweeting?
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at are you active or not. So if you're tweeting once a month, you get the discount. If you're tweeting every day, you get some appreciation. So those four things might be one or two other things in there that I don't remember. But it's a combination of things. It's not just the number of your followers. And I tell you what, that's pissed a lot of people off because some people who have a ton of followers are really mad that they don't have a better Twitter grade than they think they should.
Well, I think it's fair to say that this is brand new territory, and all of us are figuring out what the best technology solution is for our relative engagement with various companies. The whole concept of personal branding. So I think it's fair to question as much as it is fair to decide, this is our stake in the ground, at least for this period of time,
yep,
to try to figure out, if it makes sense to move it or not, but not move it based on the controversy. And frankly, the controversy's probably helped you.
It does. I hate to admit it does.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen particular spikes around any particular person of influence talking about your grading system?
I haven't personally. The only time it came across my radar is Guy Kawasaki took issue with our algorithm, and we know Guy a little bit from the early days of HubSpot, and we're big fans of his. We have a conference room named after him here at HubSpot. He's been very influential on us, so he sent me an email saying, "How the hell did you come up with this grade?" Basically, and he made some interesting points, and we actually tweaked it. We didn't tweak it exactly the way he wanted, but we did tweak it based on some of his feedback. He had some pretty good ideas on how to make it better. And it changes. My co-founder, Dharmesh, is the brains of the operation. He tweaks it. Every couple of months he'll have an idea of how he should tweak it, and he'll do a bunch of math on how it's off. And does the same thing with Website Grader. Twitter Grader's algorithm is a lot simpler than Website Grader. Website Grader looks at 50 different things and mixes them together in a special sauce algorithm to come up with a score.
And I think what's interesting, too, is not just Guy Kawasaki, but a friend of mine, Chris Brogan, is somebody that you has been included on webinars or seems to be associated with HubSpot at different moments.
Yeah, HubSpot advisory board member.
Yeah, he's just a fantastic person. I can't say enough good things about Chris Brogan, which is part of the reason that, you have affinity for certain companies based on the social capital of other people that you know, and I just know that he happens to be a very, very good guy. Are there other folks that you are, because obviously being on the East Coast, we're here in the Silicon Valley, different take on things, and I think it's all valuable because it adds context and richness to the social media environment. Any other sort of social media mavens that are out there that you have included in various ways, whether it be advisory board, webinars, et cetera?
Yeah, the one person who's probably been most influential is David Meerman Scott.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book that a lot of people know about, The New Rules of PR Marketing, and he's also on our advisory board and has been super helpful to HubSpot. And the interesting thing about him is we didn't know about him when we started the company, and my VP of Marketing, Mike Volpe, went off on his honeymoon, and he brought his book with him, and he read the book, and when he came back, he dropped the book on my desk. He's like, "I know you read a lot. This is a must-read," and I read it. And David Meerman's got The New Rules in PR Marketing was basically the book version of the company we were trying to build. So we reached out to him and said, "We got to get together. You basically wrote a book that's exactly like our software company." And we sort of really hit it off. And if it's one of those people, like if I drew a Venn diagram of my interests and David's, they're just incredibly overlapped. He's really into the Grateful Dead. He spends his summers on Nantucket. He used to live in Asia, and he's really into this marketing stuff. And all those things are in common with me. And so he's been very, very influential with us.
Bio doesn't talk about time in Asia, though.
It probably should. It probably should.
I want to, before we get too off topic, away from sort of your core offering, you know, people, as I said, they really know you for the free tools. And, you know, they've inspired controversy. But I think regardless from my perspective, I've seen much more positive response than negative. Because, you know, obviously if you're using it as one of the things that you consider and you are hopefully working with someone to help you figure this out, you're, you know, kind of using the law of averages to some extent to figure out exactly what influence means. But that's not the only offering you have. Do you want to tell folks about, you know, you've talked about being and kind of defining yourself as a software company, and you offer a SaaS solution, as I understand it. Do you want to talk to us about what that is and what it does for companies?
Sure. If you like Twitter Grader, Website Grader, basically what we're doing with that is taking little tiny pieces of our software product, breaking them off, and giving them for free to the community. And so what HubSpot is sort of a modern marketing platform. There's a bunch of applications in there that are woven together into a cool modern marketing platform. So there's a great set of SEO tools in there. So you don't have to go out and hire an SEO consultant. HubSpot sort of automated the process of search engine optimizing your site. There's blogging software in there. And the blogging software is really cool because you can create content in there. And because it's integrated with the SEO, as you're writing content, it makes suggestions on how to optimize your site in really interesting ways. There's social media tools in there. So you don't have to go to, you know, there's a bunch of new social media monitoring companies out there. There's a whole bunch of social media tools inside of HubSpot. So, for example, because we know all your keywords that you're interested in, we know all your brands, we know all your competitors, we listen on the Internet. We listen on Twitter. We listen on Facebook. We listen across the blogosphere for when conversations are happening about your brand, when conversations are happening about your industry, and we alert you of them and tell you to jump in. So, for example, there's a conversation happening on LinkedIn Answers about your industry. Mm-hmm. Jump in right now. So a little bit of SEO, a little bit of blogging, a little bit of social media. And then we have a web analytics package that's sort of a closed-loop marketing analytics tool that's a little bit like Google Analytics but built for a marketer who wants to look at the whole funnel from the very top to the very bottom. And then there's kind of landing pages software in there as well. And it's all kind of pulled together in one simple system. And it's really built for a small, medium-sized company, not for a big enterprise. That sort of pops out. And we're a little bit inspired by the iPod. So when I think about Apple and the iPod, before the iPod came out, there were tons of MP3 players on the market. And real deeply technical people liked them, and they could figure out how to friggin' use them because they were really complicated back then. What's brilliant about Apple is they said, we're not going to make a better MP3 player. We're actually going to make a worse one. We're going to make it simpler. And we're going to optimize around integration with the iTunes and make it really easy for people to get the music in. Because we were able to integrate it and make it really simple, they get kind of all the unwashed masses sort of to start enjoying this new technology. And that's a little bit of our thesis around HubSpot. You don't have to go out and buy blogging software, buy SEO software, buy landing pages software, buy web analytics, buy social media tools. You have one very simple integrated system from one vendor along with really good support to help you kind of transform the way you market, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so many ways that I could go on and on about how I agree with so much of what you're saying. But, yeah, you know, there's the collective intelligence that basically, you know, companies need to understand to leverage or to be helped to leverage using, I think, a combination of software technology and then the interpretation of that in some way, whether it's internal or external.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I do is obviously open up the questions to the Twitter community and, of course, my colleagues. And one of my colleagues has put the question, you know, what are some of the most common concerns or issues that are driving companies to seek HubSpot's counsel? And
yeah.
Have those issues changed over the past year, given the economy, et cetera?
Yeah, I think they have. We've seen a kind of a positive impact from the economy. And the nice thing about this new type of, we call it inbound marketing, modern marketing, is it's not about kind of the width of your wallet. It's more about the width of your brain. You know, inbound marketing is about how do you create interesting content, like the content we create as a company is our blog and then these greater tools.
Mm-hmm.
How do you create blogs or online TV shows or webinars, things like that. And how do you pull people in with that interesting content? So it's about, can you unleash the creativity in your company? Can you unleash the smart people in your company to create great content and use that as your lead gen strategy and stop spending money on ads, stop spending money on Google AdWords, stop spending money on the traditional stuff that just doesn't work anymore. And so as people have seen their marketing budget scrutinized, the inbound marketing story has become very appealing to them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would agree with everything you've said. The one thing that we call it content strategy, but what we do is look at, one of the first things we do is assess what a company is already doing well potentially in the content arena that they don't even realize.
Right.
And so to kind of map to their skill set so that they can play to their strengths as they seem to appear, or you might find a pain point, getting out white papers with, referenceable quotes from companies may be a pain point that they need assistance getting done. Or, in this world of Twitter, a quote from an unnamed source that is very powerful can be under 140 characters and a really great testament to a powerful source if it's, obviously truthful and, as transparent as it's allowed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the first part of the question I think we should probably focus on a little bit, which is, common concerns and issues, that drive people to you. What do you find those being?
I think people are seeing that they go to Google. The CEO of the company will go to Google and they'll search on XYZ. They'll search on the company name and they'll come up first. And so that would satisfy them for a while. But now the CEO of the company goes and searches some industrial term and finds out that they're buried on page 5 of that term.
Yeah.
That gets people going. that gets the CEO firing up the VP of marketing.
Right, the prominence within market or vertical.
Yep. The other thing that fires the CEO up relative to Google is the Google AdWords budget is just out of control and keeps going up and up and up and up. He's like, there's got to be a better way. How do we start getting ranking organically in Google? That gets a lot of people going. More recently, it's a lot of the social media stuff that gets people going. CEO of the company does the search on search.twitter.com and looks up his brand and says, oh, my God, people are talking about our industry and our brand. How do we get our arms around this? Who can help? That gets people fired up and gets them into our funnel. And then a lot of people now are coming to the conclusion that they need a blog, and they don't kind of want to go to WordPress. They want their blog to match their website and all that kind of stuff, so they'll come to us for that. But the fundamental thing that's driving people, though, is just it's expensive as hell to acquire customers. They're not acquiring customers faster, and they think maybe HubSpot's got an answer for how they could drive down their cost to acquire customers and just get more customers much more effectively, particularly in this economy that's getting a lot of attention.
So what do you think about some of these, some of the services out there that have brand new Salesforce.com integrations with the Twitter app that's sort of out? I think it was out and then had some problems and then kind of is back on the shelf. But, the basically Twitter tools that are tools from Salesforce.com leveraging APIs to be able to integrate their CRM and lead gen tools into your tool potentially.
I think what Salesforce is doing is really cool. I'm really psyched to see him doing that. It's very similar to some of the stuff HubSpot's doing. I think it's very encouraging to see Salesforce doing it. When we grow up, we want to be the Salesforce.com of marketing. We really respect those guys. So it's really interesting to see them hopping onto that. Their angle thus far, I was out at Salesforce a couple weeks ago talking to them about this, has been more around the customer service side. How do we listen for problems and how do we respond to issues more effectively? And I think it's been less on the marketing side, but it makes perfect sense for them to start thinking about that on the marketing side as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I know of one technology I demoed this week where it drops. You can drop in sales leads that you find through monitoring a particular company, as a listening tool and provide, leads in the queue.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's getting so sophisticated that you can actually, I think we're getting so close to ROI, I can, you know, just barely grasp, you know, it's just out of my grasp. But I think, you know, I mean, and I think there's good explanations for ROI anyway. But, you know, I think we're getting clearly to that point. What's your sort of perspective on ROI when people challenge you as to, you know, I assume your technology, your full package is a has a costing structure. You obviously have free services, but when people want to engage with you, SMBs want to engage with you, you know, what are some of the, in the early engagement process, what are some of the things that they're challenging you with in terms of performance-based models maybe, or, you know, really everything coming down to how do I measure return on investment?
Yep. We've got some really good metrics on that. So our average customer who buys, let's say they buy and they've got 100 leads a month coming in, within 6 months they've grown it 6x, so they'll have 600 leads a month. And our software is relatively cheap, frankly. It's $500 a month. So people don't generally get too wrapped around the axle around ROI and HubSpot. It's just not expensive enough to get too wrapped around the axle. Where I think people get wrapped around the axle is the time invested. So if I'm going to invest time in Twitter or invest time in Facebook or invest time in a blog, how do I measure the results from that? And we do help them do that. So within HubSpot, there's sort of a campaign management system where you can look at sort of the top of your funnel and say, well, how many visitors did I get to my site from Twitter this month? How many did I get through my blog? And then I'll look at visitors, and then I'll look at how many of those visitors turned into leads, and then I'll look at how many of those leads turned into customers, because HubSpot does integrate with Salesforce.com. All the lead info flows through into Salesforce. So we've got a picture of your entire funnel within HubSpot, so we can look at what's really working and converting into leads, so we can tell our customer whether, you know, what's the shape of the funnel for Twitter relative to seminars, relative to Facebook, relative to your blog, relative to that last email marketing blast you did, and we can help them with that ROI. So we try to get as close as we can to ROI. It's hard to calculate the time you're investing in this kind of stuff, but at least you can measure it relative to your other sort of older school programs.
Well, you know, one thing that I think is kind of interesting is, you know, what is, we have, again, another question for one of my colleagues. What's the one thing you think every company needs to invest in this economy from an internet marketing perspective?
I think it's content. I thought you hit on it earlier. I mean, if you look at the people who really win on the internet, it's people who can create, I'm going to steal a term from Seth Godin, remarkable content. I really like how he uses that term, remarkable, because if you think about the internet, pre-internet, it was expensive as hell to spread your message. Mm-hmm. You had to buy your way with a PR company into, you know, InfoWeek or whatever the important journal you had to have. You had to spend your way with a PR company to get into those magazines. You had to pay for trade shows. You had to pay for seminars. You had to pay for advertising. And you had to push a rock up the hill. But now on the internet, if you do have something remarkable that's interesting and new, like Twitter Grader, for example, is kind of remarkable, boy, does it spread itself fast. So if you're the kind of company that has unique products or doing innovative stuff, it's a great time to it's a great time to be a marketer. It's a great time to be an entrepreneur around that. But what the essential thing to me is that you've got a remarkable product and you create remarkable content about that product. So as a marketer today, I think your job is half journalist, half content creator, and it's half traditional marketer. You have to have a strategy around creating an awesome blog, creating an awesome live television show, creating awesome little applications that are remarkable, that draw people in. It's the central thing is content, creating remarkable content.
Mm-hmm. And so speaking of sort of, you know, I guess content being a way of pulling people in, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this. You know, obviously you want people to respond to the content in some way. And, you know, you see that, you know, there's a lot of people that are out blogging, they're out Twittering, and they don't necessarily have a strategy around what they're doing. And I think the content hopefully should inform that strategy, but maybe there's a piece missing before they go out into the big wide world and start trying to embrace two-way communication with customers, whether they're angry or not, and potential leads and all of that. Do you think that there's a strategy piece that maybe is missing? And how do you, how would you advise clients to make sure they're doing things strategically? Or do you think that's even important?
I think it's important. The thing I've seen just work is, what I've seen that doesn't work is when people start a Facebook page or a Twitter page and they start tweeting. I don't think Twitter on its own and Facebook on its own really works. What works particularly well is the interplay between the content you're creating and the social media stuff. So we advise people, it's like, create that great content, optimize it, and when you optimize it for Google, but also optimize it so it's like it's Twitter friendly and it's Facebook friendly, and then promote it in the social media sphere, and then measure sort of your funnel shape from it. So it's like this kind of closed loop thing that you try to do. The combination and the interplay between the content and the social media sphere was what really works. Just chirping on the social media sphere, I don't think gets you much. It's how do you get your content and spread it virally in the social media sphere. That's what I think the key is to real success on the internet.
Which is really kind of, I think, where we're, where I'm kind of talking about strategy is that, actually something happens and grows and is scalable or maturable out of whatever your effort is. Otherwise, it's hard to make a case that you should spend employee time or time on, make a software technology expenditure without having that in mind, right?
Yep, I totally agree. And if you don't have a lot of companies, let's say Jennifer, you're in the screw business. You got a screw, and you're competing with 100 other screw companies, and you're just competing on price. It's actually pretty hard to create compelling content about that. And the internet may not be for you. The internet is for somebody who's got a remarkable, unique value prop. Because if you get a remarkable, unique value prop, boy, it's going to spread. And the strategy piece is, what is unique about our products and services? And thinking hard about that, and then creating remarkable content about how you're unique. And surprising number of companies don't get that right. A big pothole I see companies falling in is in creating, instead of creating content, for example, about their marketplace and about their unique perspective on the marketplace, they're overselling their products. They're in there just chirping about their products and then chirping on their blog and then spreading that message through the social media sphere just about their products, and they're selling too hard. And it's hard to sell hard on the internet. If you talk about your industry, that spreads very quickly. But if you talk about your products, people don't want to help you spread it very well. So that's another kind of pothole I see people stepping in.
Yeah, you find that we had a situation this week where we had a client that blogged about another company in the space, kind of shockingly going apparently out of business or having to reorganize significantly so that they won't be a player, it looks like, in the future. And the first words of the CEO actually wrote himself on his blog was something to the effect of, my heart goes out to this company, and I feel terrible hearing this news. This makes me think of, my own company and, how we can differentiate ourselves in this market and kind of, in a way of reassuring customers as well as reassuring investors. And actually a reporter took him to task for that and, called his post as well as that of another company vulture-like, when if you look at it and it's, the life cycle of it, you can actually turn it around on the reporter and say, in this era of, financial commitment, to companies being so, so difficult to come by, CEOs have to answer more than ever to VCs or whomever, and they owe them an explanation, and what better way to do it than to also include customers in that equation. And, if a reporter jumps on you for saying something about someone going out of business, even nicely stated, it's amazing that they can sort of be attacked for that. One of the things I think, so getting back to, you have a blog grader, kind of coming out. Does it have any kind of sense? Because one thing I get concerned about, obviously, working with clients is the, you know, kind of in that example, that was a good way, potentially, of mentioning another company. Because it really was about kind of defending the industry and, you know, making sure that people that had invested felt assured, that customers felt assured that they weren't going anywhere, et cetera. But then others, some other CEOs might have the, you know, inclination to kind of go negative or specifically pick on other companies instead of focusing on their own unique, you know, value prop. You know, what makes you unique? Why do we care about you over someone else? You know, how is that going to work in terms of a tool for blogging when sentiment of a post is starting to become a metric that people are talking about more and more? Or maybe not even a metric, but a phrase that's coming up more and more.
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic. I would say for our customers, there's two things people are interested in these days. It seems like they're either interested in getting more leads, or they're interested in kind of managing their brand and making sure nothing happens like the whole Domino's incident that happened last month. Our customers are more on the lead gen side, and they're smaller companies, and they're not Cisco. They don't have this big brand they're trying to manage and defend. What they're trying to do is really just leverage the conversation out there to pull people into their site and turn their site into a hub. And it's like, that's a good problem to have for most SMBs, is managing a reporter who says something bad about a blog post to you. So I don't think about that a lot. I know a lot of the new social media companies, Nielsen Buzzmetrics and Radiant 6 and Visible Technologies, are really looking into that sentiment stuff. HubSpot, in the way we think, is really more around how do you leverage the social media sphere to get found, and less about managing your brand and worrying about your brand. It's probably not the answer you wanted, but that's how I think about it.
Oh, no, I don't want any answer. I want a real one. So as long as it's real, I'm happy with it. Yeah, and in this example, it was an SMB.
Okay.
You know, it was a startup. So, you know, I think, you know, there, and of course there's bigger companies that we work with that are completely concerned about detractors, almost trolls.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are other places where, you know, that could influence, obviously, the way that a company is positioned in the blogosphere.
Yeah.
And sort of speaking of influence, in the larger topic of this show, which is, you know, where and how influence happens, how do you define influence?
We're really busy on that. That's sort of what we're trying to get at with Twitter Grader, how influential is your Twitter account? We do the same thing with Facebook Grader. And eventually we're going to build a, you know, person grader. We're going to basically try to have the social graph online, and you come online and tell us who you are, and we'll be able to tell you from what's going on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter and all these different sites how influential you really are. I think we're getting to the point where we can kind of measure that. I think influence online is just incredibly important these days, and the sooner companies can get their arms around it and start figuring it out, the better. So what that's about trying to do is just give you the tools to increase your influence and then give you tools to sort of measure it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good answer. I think very technology-focused, though, which is a little surprising for me from a company that, you know, I guess I expected a different answer. I don't know why, but I think technology and science, I mean, have come a long way. You know, it's like we've come a long way, baby, and I like answers like that because I think that, again, it goes back to the proof of concept. You know, you're able to get past that point and actually get to the business at hand.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we, you know, working with lots of different kinds of companies, some international with different philosophies about the approach to marketing or the approach to public relations or the approach to whatever piece we're working with them on, you know, they hear the term embrace technology, but sometimes it feels like it's just a buzz phrase. It doesn't really ring true.
Mm.
So, you know, we try to encourage companies to consider, you know, different internet marketing, you know, ways of using internet marketing to really get them to embrace technology and what it can do to sort of help move the conversation forward. And basically, when I say technology, I'm talking about the tools, the social media tools, and I would include Twitter and Facebook and those sorts of things, more LinkedIn probably for a lot of our clients. But in terms of clients that might be skeptical still of social media engagement, you know, kind of how would you get them, or what would you say to them to hopefully get them to embrace technology or embrace social media as more than just a buzz phase or a phase of something that's, you know, not going to last?
Yeah, I definitely see it. And I think it's largely, I shouldn't probably be saying this, it's largely a function of age. I can kind of see it when I just finished a meeting with a customer about 5 minutes before the call. And if they're sort of, there's this book out that talks about the digital natives and digital immigrants, that they sort of grew up with the internet and live and breathe the internet, they just inherently get it. But some people, let's say you're the VP of marketing and you're in your 60s and you didn't grow up with it and for some reason you didn't gravitate toward it, it can be hard to convince someone. And I think it's a little bit like, you know people who are handy around the house, like you're really good with a saw and you're really good with a wrench and you can build a shed out back, but you can also fix the sink. That's the way it is with the internet. Some people are just love it and gravitate toward it and are handy around it. Some people aren't. And it tends to be younger people who are better with it. What I like to do with folks who maybe, you know, don't get it or are resistant or think it's a fad is I generally like to go into Twitter and go to search.twitter.com and search on their brand or search on their competitor and check them out that way. The other thing I like to do with people is with the website grader tool is you can put in your URL and your competitor's URL and then do like a side-by-side comparison on how powerful your site is relative to your competitor's. And you can kind of show them, if their competitor's ahead of them, that they're falling behind in the race and they need to catch up. So those are two sort of, I'm an engineer, so sort of scientific engineering ways to convince people who haven't bought into the use of technology for their marketing department.
Both great answers. And we're past the halfway point. Actually, we have only have about 15 minutes left, but I just want to welcome those that are joining us later in the program to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I'm speaking with Brian Halligan, who's the co-founder and CEO of HubSpot. So moving on, I think that there's, you know, again, my colleagues have primed me with tons of questions for you because I think everybody's so interested in your company, either because our clients are trying out your free products or, you know, we're figuring out, you know, how our services, basically cohabitate with yours and in the space that we're in and that sort of thing. I think in the end there's plenty to go around and we all offer different options.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, one of the things that you bring to the table is obviously a technology perspective. And, you know, one of the questions that came from one of my colleagues is, what are some of the next technologies you see coming around the corner that web-savvy communicators should be testing right now?
Yeah. So it's kind of a two-part question. The beginning of that was there's a lot of – so what HubSpot really focuses on is we are a core technology company, and we're not a professional services company. We want to build a big software company. And we sell a very small amount of basically training for our customers. So I think there's a lot of room for companies like, for example, yours and HubSpot to cooperate together, and we have a burgeoning partner program where, you know, if you're going into a company and you're espousing a social media marketing strategy or an SEO strategy to them or a blogging strategy and you need a platform to pull it off, you can bring in HubSpot. And then vice versa, HubSpot's got, you know, about 1,500 paying customers now. A lot of them are looking for next-generation PR companies that really get this stuff and services companies who can really help them think some of this stuff through beyond the sort of technical stuff and software piece that HubSpot does. So that's sort of the first piece. I'm sorry, I forgot the second piece you were asking about.
Well, I think we just violently agreed.
Okay.
So that's a great thing.
Okay.
But technology companies, looking, what should we, you know, collectively as, you know, sort of the communication side, I'm probably the most technical in my company, and so I'm certainly looking at technology, but for others that may be a little less technical, what should they be looking at and getting demos of right now, or looking, you know, maybe putting a Google alert on to be tracking in terms of new technologies that are coming down the pipeline that are important in the internet marketing space? And, you know, in the term you phrased, you know, inbound marketing and that whole arena.
Yeah. I'll tell you some of the stuff that I use, and it may not be cutting edge. I use compete.com a lot these days. I think that service is pretty good. Do you use that?
We definitely use it. Yep.
Yeah, I like it a lot. You know, surprising number of people don't use RSS. Get Google Reader set up and just use that. It's very, you know, if you really want to be a participant in the internet and you really want to get active in the blogosphere, conversations happen very quickly and then they end. So you sort of need to be really cooking on RSS if you want to be engaged in what's happening on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. Another one that people don't talk about, it's not a new one, but is extremely effective, is LinkedIn. So, for example, if you can create a LinkedIn group, and the group's got an interesting name that people want that badge on their LinkedIn page,
mm-hmm.
that's just very few people talk about it, but it's an awesome way to market your products and services and become a thought leader to huge, huge numbers of people.
So yeah, it's a funny thing that you say that, because Mario Sundar from LinkedIn was on a few weeks ago, and we were going on and on about how much we were geeking out about how much we love groups, and there's even new group features that came out this week with the subgroups.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so we follow that very closely.
Yeah,
so, yeah, I would totally agree.
And that's why we have a group called Pro Marketers. And because that's an interesting name, Pro Marketers, and you kind of want a name like that on your badge, on your profile, you know,
mm-hmm.
if you're looking for a job at some point or someone's trying to recruit you or whatever, if you name it right, people will join it. And every time someone joins it, it pops up in the LinkedIn alerts, and it will spread. So if you have the right name for your LinkedIn group, it can be very, very effective. And we have tens of thousands of people now in our LinkedIn group, and we send them an email once a month. We don't spam them. We send them an email with a bunch of free stuff on there. So we send them, oh, here's Twitter Grader, here's Facebook Grader, here's our latest webinar, and hopefully they'll go to Twitter Grader, Facebook Grader, or the webinar and connect the dots and end up at HubSpot, so we're subtle about it. But that's a hidden gem, is the LinkedIn group that very few people.
Oh, they are. They're awesome. There's a few other things that are great about them. So what other tools besides LinkedIn groups?
There's not a lot of really new cutting-edge stuff that I'm using. I mean, everyone's just obsessed with Twitter. There's so much Twitter obsession. It's a little tiring.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, it comes up in every conversation.
Yeah.
And you know, people forget that it's been around for years, that it's a platform that, you know, for example, people, you know, when people were looking at the measurement from the site perspective and not looking at the fact that it is a tool that is wherever you want it to be, so people are engaging with it on mobile or whatever. You know, to me, that is the perfect product. You know, it is. You know, it comes to you in whatever form you want it to. I think having worked for media companies for more than a decade, that's kind of what I always described as the holy grail. Is it shouldn't matter whether it's a PC or whatever a PC becomes, or a TV or whatever a TV becomes. We have to be nimble enough for that and everything in between to be the platform.
It'll be interesting.
You have to be platform agnostic.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with Twitter. I mean, what's so fascinating about Facebook, so I was on this panel last night. There's a bunch of VCs on the panel, and somebody asked a question about, well, when do you invest in a Me Too company, or how do you avoid the temptation of investing in Me Too companies? And the example that came up was Facebook. I mean, talk about a Me Too company. You had MySpace out there, you had Friendster out there, and Facebook just executed really, really well and ended up winning that game. I wonder what will happen with Twitter. There seems to be these flows of big social media platforms that come and go in a very rapid way, and I wonder what will happen to Twitter over the long term, if they'll be able to hold on and sustain, if they get acquired by Google or Microsoft. It'll be very interesting to see how the whole Twitter thing plays out.
I think undoubtedly in terms of influence, the one thing that I find, I went to Columbia Journalism School, so I'm on the J School listserv, and one thing that I was pointing out when people were talking about, you know, because everybody's so concerned about their jobs and the integrity of journalism in this whole, you know, kind of for a lot of people, they would call it a quagmire.
Yeah.
Of you know, the new age of journalism. But, you know, I kind of proposed the concept. People were saying, you know, what can you get across in 140 characters? It's basically ruined the idea of a story. And I've said, you know, well, wait a minute. Mobile is here, and it's been in other countries for a very long time. The UK, they speak the same language as we do, and it's huge. And so isn't there maybe a translatable value in learning to really write short, or if you look at it a different way, really compelling headlines that then, you know, send people to a deeper story so they can get, you know, they can find out, you know, through the compelling writing. You know, I think you just have to get better at the 140 characters. And, you know, since it's based on texting, I think, you know, it's based on a platform that Gen Y gets because, you know, we all know they're avid texters. So I think hopefully it's a skill that translates well and will help people sustain their careers as generational shifts occur, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, a couple of interesting things around that. It's interesting how Twitter hasn't exploded in Europe and Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's because in Twitter in Asia, they just adopted SMS, so much earlier than we did, and it was so much more widespread, and the U.S. was pretty late to that game, and Twitter kind of came in at the right time here in the U.S. And it'll be interesting to see if it ever does really catch on like wildfire overseas like it has here in the U.S. I wonder if because people are so much more familiar with their mobile phones and so much more familiar with SMS that Twitter doesn't seem new and interesting to them like it does to us here, us Luddites here in America.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that, you know, playing on my experience having worked for a South African media company that had a very much a reverse BRIC strategy, so Brazil, Russia, India, Asia, South Africa, those being the target markets, with so much fraud happening on actual computers because people don't own them individually, they're going to internet cafes and so much fraud happening, they're doing all kinds of advanced e-commerce and all kinds of other things. Their relationship with their phone is so different than it is with ours. We're just starting, I mean, I think it's just barely the tip of the iceberg with what we're doing here. But, I mean, the fact that you can fly into Beijing and get a welcome to Beijing, please, you know, in English.
Right.
So it knows so much about you already, you know, and it's like, how did this text find me and know that I wanted to have dinner, so it knows the time of day, and it knows that, you know, it's going to recommend a few places near where I'm staying, maybe coincidentally, maybe not, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's a great example of, you know, how advanced the technology is, and regardless, eventually, we'll catch up here with mobile, and I think that the value of that, the character count, is going to be a translatable skill, whether Twitter exists or not. So I think, you know, I tell companies this, it's worth looking at content quality from a short character perspective in part of the content strategy piece, because I think we will continue to see, you know, people needing snippets, you know, on their phones, because phones are obviously smaller than computers. And even, you know, I can't believe how every person I know that has a parent that's a baby boomer love these micro laptops, despite people complaining about, I find people that are, you know, their children maybe are complaining about the size of the keyboard and all of that. My mother, you know, is a baby boomer and loves hers. I mean, just absolutely loves it. She can throw it in her purse. She's got her little laptop with her. It's just, you know, she thinks it's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
I love your riffing this on some very interesting stuff. So if I think about traditional journalism school and what they teach, I'm not a journalist, but imagine if I were designing a modern journalism school, like there'd be a class on how do you write in 140 characters? How do you do comments properly, and how do you handle comments on your blog? How do you write really compelling titles of your blog so it spreads not only in Google, but it spreads in the social media sphere? Like, that must be where journalism schools are going today, because that's how you spread your message. You spread it in 140 characters. You don't spread it, you know, through long-form text anymore. Is it heading that way?
When I went to journalism school, it didn't. And, you know, one of so personal story, you know, one of my frustrations was I had worked in the industry for 7 years, so I took a break to get my master's degree to be able to move up the food chain and really know my industry. So I learned every aspect, even though I had been heavy television and then new media very early on. In 99, I switched to doing new media in the first boom and bust. And in any event, I ended up working for ABC. So I had come from, you know, a network, but from a particular region. So was working from the West Coast. And you know, our broadcast professor, one of my biggest frustrations was her entire experience was working at Nightline. And, you know, I just saw that as something that really didn't translate to the modern journalist. However, there are people like Sri Srivanathan, whose name I've just probably butchered, but we know him as Professor Sri, who's fighting the good fight and is now one of the deans at the journalism school and is actively engaging with those of us that are new media alumni to ask these very questions, which is, you know, what should we be teaching? And I think places like Media Bistro, where a lot of graduates gravitate towards, you know, do a great job of providing kind of supplemental information and sessions where people can start picking up on what they do need to know so that they're demanding that of their programs. With admissions, as we all know, up for journalism programs despite the economy, I think that their careers depend on it. And I see more and more very high-profile alumnus, you know, really weighing in on this and saying, you know, it's all digital, folks. You know, teaching X, Y, or Z is not important anymore.
I actually think the marketing programs and the journalism programs should be merging. When what we advise our customers is when their marketing department should be, you know, half journalists, half marketers. So our second marketing hire was a former writer from the New York Times, a guy named Rick Burns, who's now our main content creator. It's just a very different profile today. And the way you teach a marketer, it's like there's four attributes of kind of a marketer should have that kind of, a lot of it overlaps with what a journalism major would have. And I call it DARK, D-A-R-K. The D stands for digital native. Are you sort of native and facile with all these web tools? The A in DARK is analytical. How analytical are you? You're good with spreadsheets? Are you good with pivot tables? Do you really get to how to analyze all this data? The R is kind of for reach. What is your reach on the internet? Do you have a blog with lots of followers? Do you have a lot of Facebook friends? Do you have a lot of Twitter friends? Because if I bring you on, I want to extend my reach within your reach. And then the C is for content creator. Can you create kind of lots and lots of content? Can you be a content creation factory for me inside my company? So I almost think the journalism marketing thing should be merged inside of schools, or there should be a bunch of journalism classes given to marketing and marketing classes in business school these days.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of overlap, although I think it probably would have to be phrased differently to not give some people I know a heart attack. but a couple of quick questions, if I can just shoot them off in the last very few minutes we have. What do you wish you'd known before you started this business? One thing.
I wish I'd known before I started this business. What's your second question?
So what two pieces of advice would you give young entrepreneurs?
If I were a young entrepreneur, I'd really take advantage of all this inbound marketing stuff to build my whole company, you know, really create lots of interesting content about your remarkable product. Really get active on Twitter, get active in the blogosphere, get active in Facebook, and take advantage of all this stuff. My other piece of advice would be find a great co-founder. You don't want to start a company by yourself, in my opinion. It's just very lonely at the top and sends a negative signal to investors. Find a great co-founder who really complements your skills, not with a heavy overlap.
And all the companies right now that we're looking at that are potentially being acquired, Twitter being a good example, all in twos.
Yeah. I think what really worked well for me is I'm sort of the sales and marketing guy. My co-founder is the sort of tech visionary type. And it's just worked extremely well. If you look at you know, so many of the companies, Microsoft, and on, there's usually that combination of people in there that works really well. It's tempting to start a company with your best friend with the same background, but you're better off starting someone who complements you well that you get along with.
So what would your co-founder maybe say to what they wish they would have known before they started the business? Getting back to the first question.
What would we wish we had known before we started the business?
I mean, you clearly come from a technology background. Was there something that you really felt you had to kind of, was a little bit of an uphill battle to learn? Or a book that, you know, as you mentioned earlier, New Rules of PR Marketing, you know, was sort of a discovery that really...
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing that's counterintuitive about HubSpot is neither Dharmesh or I came from the marketing software background. There's a bunch of marketing software companies out there, from Eloqua to Marketo to the Google Analytics of the world to Omniture. Neither of us really knew anything about that stuff before we started the company. So we came into it and just built a product for our friends who were running small businesses and venture-backed software companies. And that really helped us sort of ignore the sort of all the existing norms within the industry and just build it the way we thought it made sense. And I think that really benefited us, that we were unwise about how the industry worked, and that's really helped us actually build a bigger, better company faster because we ignored all the rules that were already in place.
Well, very good. I'm going to have to end it there with you, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us. Everybody go to HubSpot.com, check out what they have to offer. And with that, I will thank you, our guests, for tuning in to Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, thanks to the 4th of July holiday, we'll be broadcasting on Thursday, July 2nd. Stay tuned to blogs.eastwick.com for the latest on our guests. Or better yet, sign up to have our blog post emailed to you at your computer or to your mobile phone. Again, go to blogs.eastwick.com for details. Have a great weekend, everybody.